Dearest gentle souls, the strangest and most wonderful things happened today. I was out riding my bicycle right on the outskirts of town and enjoyed the beautiful summer morning when the loudest sound I've ever heard erupted from the skies. Sweet reader, I must say it was so piercing and wonderful my nose started to bleed and my gums, well, they bled even more than they usually do. That's quite the feat. I must have lost consciousness for a moment or two because I found myself on the side of the road, all tangled up in my pretty unicorn bicycle. It was scuffed up and scratched, and I was so angry I could spit. But then as I rode into town, I found a good reason to swallow that mouthful. Oh, friends, the town in which I spent my life had changed so remarkably, I can scarcely explain. Me, the writer, lost for words. Quite the example of irony, though. Or is it a coincidence? I could never get those straight. It doesn't much matter right now. Handsome and comely readers, let me do my best to tell you about some townsfolk who are opened and left to ripen on that lovely August sunshine. Randy Dixon, the police officer who'd taken me in for some random questioning more times than I can count, was the first one I identified. It was the mustache. His silly body was wide open from his chin to his unmentionables. All those pink and yellow guts from his chubby self were made into a circle around him. It was even made into a pretty design with a star in the middle. Muhammad Ahad, the man who owned the Middle Eastern grocery store that had all sorts of tasty exotic yummies, was nearby. Whatever got him must have been strong. Poor Muhammad's backbone was in his mouth, and his big, adorable brown eyes were all gone. They'd always twinkle when he watched me shop at the store. I always pretend that he had a crush on me, but I knew it was against his religion for him to have feelings for such a handsome writer like myself. Oh well. I guess I'll have to just leave that in the past. Bye, Muhammad. There was a bunch of other silly-looking townsfolks in the square all piled by the fountain. The water was red. It was so pretty. Like liquid rubies. Oh, I like that. I have to say liquid rubies in my next romance novel. I can't wait to read my rough draft to my family when I'm done writing this. Maybe I'll add that pretty line in. Pretty liquid rubies. You want to hear something funny? I haven't seen a single bird or animal since that noise happened. I didn't mention that to the nice lady at the 911 dispatch. I guess she didn't think my emergency was too dire because I haven't seen any police or ambulances come yet. And it's been hours. Those boys in blue must have so much work to do, considering they have to take all the work from the station that died with the rest of the town. Oh, blood. I almost forgot the blood. I was just so busy describing the beautiful liquid rubies that I darn near forgot the connection. Kind. Almost certainly intelligent readers. Have you ever seen blood dry in the sun and then turn into flies? I thought I must have been having an attack of the sillies again, because when I saw it, I nearly fainted dead away. It was prettier than I, a gifted writer, can put into words. All the shiny dried blood on the streets and in the stores and cars just bloomed. With little buzzy guys. They rose up like a humming curtain at a play about my very own hometown, then hovered in the sky. Oh, you should have seen the patterns they made. It's been many years since I was in a math class, but I remember the lessons on fractals. I saw the flies make Julia sets and Mandelbrot sets and a whole bunch of other things I used to like to draw on my homework. After they made a lot of shapes, they rained down on the ground and must have split open and made more blood, because once that dried, it all happened again. Nature is so beautiful, my perspicacious readers. I walked through the streets and saw more and more of the people who didn't like me or were polite, but wary to me. Maybe it's an unpopular opinion, but I think they look so much better all opened up. It's like they've got nothing to hide at all, and their insides are outside. Nothing's pent up. They're all relaxed, with nothing held back. It's so poetic. Remember when I mentioned the nice lady at the 911 place? She sounded so interesting. It was like she'd recorded every single word individually and then strung them together to make her sentences. I wonder if she had a stroke or something. That would be sad. I bet she's okay, though. There's another funny thing about today. While I walked around, there were all these moments where I'd get dizzy for a moment and really cold. Like, major cold. I'd get a flash of a super strange place that looked like the ground and sky were made of meat. And there were big rivers of yellow stuff that looked like it smelled bad. But I couldn't really tell. I'd only see all this for a couple seconds. Then I'd be back in town. But oh, boy, oh geez, was I cold. My skin even steamed when I got back. Reminded me of that handsome Vincey Wilfork on the Texans. Oh, goodness. Well, genuinely attractive readers, I should wrap this up. I want to go foraging for more wild mushrooms in the forest before it gets too much later, because I don't think it'll be easy to get food around here for a while. I'm so excited to read this to my family. When the noise happened and all the people in town got opened up, I worried my family might be affected. And luckily, they were just how I'd left them. They're so peaceful in their little basement home. All 9 of them. I think I'll bring some pieces of the townsfolk and drape it all around the basement like tinsel and ornaments, so the place can be festive. My family deserves the best. Just like you. Cultured and kind-hearted readers. Just like you.
I work for a large industrial and technological conglomerate. Largest, actually. I'm the lead engineer and project manager of a department called Advanced Additive Manufacturing, which is just a fancy way of saying new 3D printing technology. See, the brass at corporate are positioning our company to be at the apex of the additive manufacturing industry within the decade. So my department is lucky enough to enjoy a budget that's nearly unlimited. Far more than we actually need. I work under the company's chief technology officer and report my team's research progress directly to him. So far, progress has impressed corporate. This has resulted in a relatively laissez-faire managing of me by the CTO. What I'm doing works for him, and in turn, works for his bosses. My small team is pushed hard, but they get rewarded. They know they're on the bleeding edge of technology that'll be a primary causal factor in the next industrial revolution. Of course, the satisfaction that comes with that knowledge is augmented by salaries far beyond what they'd be making at our companies or research firms. Despite pushing them hard, I refuse to let them work more than 10 hours each day. I figure they need to have lives outside of work. Their productivity will surely decline the moment they feel their job is oppressive. The only issue with that is it forces me to put in very long hours. Every so often. Well, nevertheless, I don't feel overwhelmed or burned out. My family's on the other side of the country, so I don't see them much anyway, and all my friends work with me in other parts of the company. I love my job. I'm completely happy doing it. Anyway, one of the overarching directives of our company is full commutative ability between all manufacturers' products. Basically, by 2025, all the machines have to transmit and receive all sorts of sensory data that can be analyzed both by us for diagnostic purposes and by our customers for their own analytics. Last Christmas Eve, I was working late trying to solve a technical problem with a colleague named Rakesh. I'd borrowed Rakesh from the communications department a few days earlier because of his experience with signal processing and acoustic spectroscopy. Rakesh and I were trying to integrate a new type of communications transceiver on our latest integration of 3D printers. Now, these receivers are highly advanced prototypes. They function on a wideband petahertz frequency range, something, as far as I know, no one has done before. A lot of what Rakesh tells me is over my head. But basically, the transmission process uses fiber optic titanium sapphire laser pulses to excite supercooled low-pressure molecular deuterium. The particle excitation resonates at an extremely high frequency. A ytterbium dope fiber amplifier, which has a real-time Doppler correction software, enhances the signal strength of the frequency and then uses the software to narrow it to an oscillatory harmonic scale in which the data is encoded. Portions of that scale can then be segmented into channels by further modulating the oscillations. The receiver will handshake with the transmitter once the receiving software integrates the transmission on the proper channel and then decode the data. The benefits of Rakesh's new approach are the range and speed of these transceivers. If sufficiently amplified, a signal can be lossless transmitted from tens of thousands of kilometers at a mass data rate, thus far limited only by the spread of the signal's processor ability to write to memory. His department achieved incredible preliminary results when conducting transmission tests with his division in Singapore. Once fully vetted, sufficiently miniaturized, and integrated into our company's product line, we'll have information-dense, light-speed communication between all our devices on a pristine, unused frequency band. A breakthrough came early Christmas morning when Rakesh was able to transfer the start command from his laptop's USB-connected receiver to the 3D printer's serially connected one. Rakesh and I cheered as he went over the spectroscopic data, which showed a tightly packed sine wave of signals on the low pH range, which caused the printer to turn on, conduct a short boot sequence, and run a pre-programmed manufacturing sequence that yielded a small sheet of graphene. As I said before, our 3D printers are advanced. They're far beyond anything our competitors can hope to have for at least 20 years. We manipulate individual atoms with precision that, even to me, seems magical. The graphene Rakesh and I made wasn't through normal epitaxial deposition, no. But through the concentrated effort of the printer's thousands of manipulator tips fitting the atoms together with infinitesimally small but perfectly measured bursts of electricity. My team has lately been working to exploit the valency of carbon to produce new allotropes that could serve as potentially upgrades to the manipulator tips of our printers. Simply put, we're using the printer to make better printers. After I sent Rakesh home to enjoy his day off, I stayed in the lab and pored over the spectrographic data. Despite not understanding the data as well as Rakesh, I still knew enough to glean usable information from it. I zoomed in and out on the graph, noting the perfect curves of the sine wave. From beginning to end, I saw something interesting when I accidentally zoomed out too far and displayed the 270 to 275 pH band. There was what looked to be a weak signal represented in sawtooth waves at 274. The signal was extremely dense, even zoomed in all the way. The waves were tightly packed together. Whatever it was, it contained a lot of data. The transceivers have reception range of 1 to 970 pH, so the data was coming across without a problem. I checked the transceiver on the printer. The printer was off, but the transceiver and the computer to which the printer was coupled with are still online. The data was being written to the computer's hard drive and then getting mirrored by the lab's drive array. I let the receiver keep pulling data while I pulled up some of the files being written to the array. The software in the transceiver was assembling the signal into a familiar-looking code structure. It looked a lot like the schemata that we used our printer files. I wondered who the hell was transmitting the stuff and thought that it might be Rakesh's guy in Singapore trying out new transmission methods in a higher frequency range for some reason. I was curious about what they'd been sending since I didn't know our CTO had given him permission to work with our printer technology. I filled the printer's carbon reserves and booted it up and directed it to the data stream. It started printing immediately. Behind the glass, tiny structures rose from the composition vat before my eyes. They had no discernible form even when finished. The assembly arm moved them from the vat to the cooling table. I watched for an hour, renewing the carbon reserves twice as the cooling table filled with a minute form. When the table filled, it lifted to the ceiling and an empty table took its place. It too got filled. I kept resupplying the reservoir with carbon and the printer kept printing. I noticed the pieces were getting progressively smaller. The assembly arm started changing its own manipulators to grasp the shrinking pieces to fill the cooling tables, but by the time the eighth table was filled, all 72 assembly arms were being employed, each using their smallest manipulators. The last two tables were covered in what looked like black dust. The printer stopped printing. I sent a command to a manipulator arm. The arm traveled to the last table and gripped a single speck of the black dust and brought the speck to the microscope. And I called it up on my screen. At 1,000 times enhancement, I saw intensely complex structures, organized valleys of perfectly placed carbon, intersected with others of varying depths. The direction of the valley seemed dependent upon what appeared to be an infinitesimal gear. I took screenshot after screenshot of the magnification, noting that the complexity only increased as I raised the magnification level. Then the speck disappeared, and out of the corner of my eye, in the area of the cooling tables, I saw a flash of light. I jerked my head in its direction and noticed the orientation of the tiny structures had changed. On the large screen that showed the camera view that focused on the tabletops, I saw they'd formed what looked like a Julia set on each table. I was utterly astonished. We'd done some work with self-assembly in the past, but it was always on a microscopic scale, involving no more than a few thousand simple molecules. This was completely uncharted territory for me. I got on the phone and I told Rakesh to get in here immediately. I think you could tell by the tone of my voice that I was excited and a little scared. While I waited for Rakesh, I called the CTO and explained to him what was going on. His interest was certainly piqued. He told me that neither Singapore nor anybody else was working on new printer schemata. And even if they were, there's no way they'd be broadcasting on the PH band. He demanded updates every 3 hours. Rakesh arrived 15 minutes later and he peered through the thick glass into the room housing the printer, the robotic assembly arms, and the cooling tables. Every 10 or so minutes, the Julia set would shift slightly, almost like they were zooming in on the next fractal level. Rakesh was as bewildered as I was. He pored over the pictures I'd taken and the microscopic details of the spec, trying to make some sense of what he was seeing. He both saw another flash of light by the cooling tables, accompanying an enormous crash as the tables dropped to the floor. The Julia set, however, remained. They floated in midair above the wreckage of the tables, tiny arcs of white electrical charge flickering between each of the 8 layers of carbon structures. The bottom 2 layers of dust-like structures rose up and interspersed themselves along the larger pieces. All the pieces started to move and lazily began to form an ovid shape. It was about 5 feet long, 3 feet tall. The shape rotated as it floated. Both Rakesh and I kept checking to make sure that the cameras in the room were picking it all up, and they were. We were staring through the glass, and the ovoid began to condense as the material started binding to itself. All the pieces looked like they were started seamlessly locking together, stopping once all that remained was a small 3-dimensional oval, pitch black, floating, slowly rotating, 4 feet above the ground, and then it dropped and hit the ground with a light thump. When it hit, it came to a rest against the base of the printer. Rakesh and I had a brief scuffle over who would don the clean room suit and retrieve the thing. He's bigger, so he won. I skulked over to the glass when he finished suiting up, left the lab, and walked next door to the printer room. He went inside and picked up the black oval. "It's light," he exclaimed, his voice muffled through his mask. I told him to put it under the microscope so we could all take a better look at its composite structure. As Rakesh started to move it, the ovoid began to dissolve into a black powder. The powder didn't fall to the ground. It circled Rakesh as if it was in his orbit, slowly spreading out as it rose upward like a black cloud. Rakesh waved his arms to push it away, but it remained. The powder started to push inward toward Rakesh. He frantically worked to brush it off of his suit, but it stuck. "Oh, fuck," Rakesh whispered. I saw the suit start to decay as if being burnt with acid. It didn't stop with his suit. Within 10 seconds, the powder had covered Rakesh's clothing. Now he was screaming. Black powder started to burn through his clothes and hair, and only his mouth and eyes moved. It almost looked like he was paralyzed from the neck down, except he stood perfectly upright. The powder had left him nude and hairless. It had coated his flesh. And I started sobbing as I saw steam rise from Rakesh as the black powder dissolved his skin. He screamed in a piercing castrati pitch and in a horrible contrast to his normal deep voice. Even his sharp inhalations were octaves higher than normal. His flesh melted away and I saw the bone of his forehead gleaming and polished as the powder flowed inside. His scream stopped immediately after. Steam pouring from Rakesh's body as he continued to be consumed. The window to the printing room was almost completely fogged up by the... I could see through it as the last of his bones were stripped of flesh and then consumed themselves. The powder reassembled itself into an ovoid that appeared slightly bigger. It floated for a minute and then dropped to the floor again, making a heavier sound when it hit. As the steam cleared from the window, I stared at the shape through my tears and I called 911. As I hung up the phone, I watched the ovoid explode upward through the ceiling and disappear. It was never seen again. The cameras in the printer room corroborated my story, which was promptly covered up by the company, and their influence and bottomless cash supply bribed every person, even tangentially associated with the police investigation. And a year later, the official story that Rakesh was tragically perished in an acid accident when a container at one of the semiconductor fabrication plants burst due to a manufacturing defect. His family was given close to $100 million. I still work for the company in a similar capacity. I can't blame them for covering up what happened. No one would understand events of that day, even if they saw the videos. It wasn't the company's fault that Rakesh died. Despite that, we now have safeguards in place that run the computer model of a new schemata, regardless of the source. These models appear to have the schemata files as a regular printing routine, but the tools on which the files run are entirely virtual and create the printout in an artificial environment. One of my new jobs is to intercept more data from the 274PH band and run it in that virtual environment. So far, over nearly 10,000 virtual print jobs, the results have been the same ovoid. It wasn't until last Wednesday morning that the transmission was marked differently. I ran the schematic in the virtual environment and watched in horror as a skeleton was gradually printed on screen, followed by bone, organ, and muscle. The final image was of a half-dissolved Rakesh. His eyes wide, not only from pain, but because his eyelids had been consumed. His open mouth exposed a raw, pinky-sized nub that used to be his tongue. Nothing but the schematic comes through on that band anymore. Every day I have to run the simulation and check for changes, and every day I see Rakesh in abject, torturous agony, even in the motionless frame showing the final phase of the model. I can still hear him scream.